I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business. The exclusive sponsor of I'll Drink to That is 750, a powerful and easy-to-use online search tool for wholesale buyers of wine and spirits in New York and New Jersey. 750 incorporates over 100 distributor portfolios and a number of unique features that make the lives of buyers simpler and more productive. One of the features I've been most excited about on 750 is the recent introduction of digital tasting books, which allow buyers to access all the pertinent details they need during tasting season right on their own phone. You know how in the past you've had to carry around a heavy, spiral-bound notebook that was a clumsy obstruction to your interaction at the tasting tables? No longer necessary, bro. With 750's digital tasting book feature, you get access to table numbers, pricing, producer name, wine, and everything else you need to make informed buying decisions, as well as your own place to put any tasting notes that you may need to refer to in the future. Digital tasting books, just another way 750 makes the life of a wholesale buyer much easier. Katharina Prum from Germany's Mosel J.J. Prum Winery is here today with us. Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
So, you're a lawyer, but you decided to get involved with the family wine business. How did that all come about?
I grew up, of course, in the wine business together with my two sisters. But after high school, I thought I should do something else, get a different experience in life, leave home, leave the estate, and went to law school. And I did that for a couple of years. But then the more distance I actually had, the more I found out about the enthusiasm I had for this life with wines. And so I decided to return.
That's interesting. How did that come about, that leaning on that enthusiasm?
I think it was a long process. First, if you grow up in a state like that, it's all you know. That's all the life you know. And I think I needed a distance to really see it from a different perspective, because you see it as a kid from the inside, but you don't see it really from the outside. And you have a different connection, which I, of course, wasn't aware of, but I actually wanted to leave and to just get a different experience. And I think it was a combination of having this distance as such and just seeing it from the outside and being confronted with a different life, maybe also missing the wine business or the wine world somehow with having that distance, because I, at law school, I had no contact with wine except one or another time having it in a pub, but usually the wine was very bad. So I started to drink beer even, which I've never expected before. So I think it was a combination of this. And then also because of my law studies, I did American law in addition to German law. And that brought me to America first. And
oh, okay.
So it was also this, first confrontation with wine in foreign countries and really being involved in some wine tastings, which was more or less a coincidence that I did it, but I met a lot of people, and also the people connection I saw from a different perspective, because before I was the daughter at home and I was maybe saying hello and goodbye, but not really involved. So after that, I was leading wine tastings, pouring wines, meeting people that knew our wines very long, and that made a huge difference for me.
Because your dad, Dr. Manfred Prum, doesn't travel much outside of Germany. So this may have been the first opportunity for certain people in the United States where you were living at that time to meet a Prum.
Yes, exactly. And I think for them it was very exciting. I didn't really think about it. I just thought, okay, I did this internship and then do tastings in New York or in San Francisco. It was a nice option for me as a very young student to really get to know these cities, which was very exciting for me. And okay, then I did a few tastings. I knew wine from as long as I could think, so it wasn't a problem for me. But for them, it was very nice, and that touched me somehow, because they were very happy to see somebody from the family, and they told me all their stories, their memories they had in combination with our wine. So that was very touching for me.
So in a way, it was getting away from Velen, where you live, and then getting to see the effect in other countries that your wines had on people,
yeah,
that sort of affected your decision to go back.
Yes, because it wasn't a way when you grow up in a state like such, you see everyday's life, and it's not glamorous or
it's
something.
Not glamorous.
So it's just hard work, and
people are wearing boots and getting up early.
Yes, exactly. And then it's Sometimes you have the nice weather, but then sometimes in harvest it's stressful. There's maybe a rainy day, or you have this and that problem, or whatever, a tractor breaks, and all these little problems you have in a business. So it was not at all glamorous, hard work, and very, very busy, because we grew up in the estate itself. So we were confronted day and night, maybe not at night, but sometimes 7 days a week with the business. So it was, I never had a problem with it, but it was also not any glamorous. And I didn't have these personal conversations with people that I had when I traveled.
And what were some of those conversations? I mean, what were certain stories that really resonated with you?
One story I remember very well was, for example, doing a tasting in San Francisco. And I met somebody who told me, well, how nice to see you. And I know your father since a very long time. I was a student once and traveled to Germany, did a bike tour along the Mosel River. And I bought 2 cases of 71 Gold Capsule. And
pretty good year, huh?
Yeah, not a bad start. As a, for a student, I think he really spent all of his money. He had nothing left for these 2 cases. And he said he brought it back and moved back to the U.S. and had a bottle every year. And he said he was building up a very intense relation to these wines. Was like a friendship that starts. You first try, you get to know each other and you know each other better. And then life continues and you experience different things and your friend does too. And so both personality develops. And he said it was really like building up a friendship with these wines. And he was very sad after, whatever, 24 years or so, when he opened the last bottle and was kind of saying farewell to this friend. And that was a very touching story for me. So things like that really impressed me a lot and made me think about the whole thing also in a different way, and caused more reflections on the meaning of the product, the cultural aspect, also the aspect that it brings a lot of enjoyment, because it's a very nice product. It's something people enjoy when whatever they have a good time in the evening. It's not like whatever producing a carpet cleaner or something, which is not a living being. So that was very fascinating for me.
And so you did decide to go back, and you worked from 2003 with your father at the winery.
Correct.
And what has that experience been like in terms of working with your father with the wines?
It's an experience that is different every day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really something where you can find rules. Of course, working with nature is different every day and you can never predict anything. One of the key things I learned is that if you have the approach we do have, like working very close with nature, not having a wine to be formed in mind, but really taking what nature gives us and try to express that every year, there's just not a rule for anything. So of course, when you start, you want to find some rules to really understand the thing and maybe have some safety to know how to deal with certain things or problems. But the more I got into it, the more I learned that there are not rules, and you have to react and try to accompany the product rather than really trying to manipulate something or forming something. And that is something, I think it's approach. Other vintners do it differently. They say, well, maybe I need this and this amount of a cabinet or Spätlese or Auslese from a certain year, or they try to explain things very scientifically. That's something we do not do. Of course, certain basics you need to know. But our approach is much more observing and experience from this observation and really trying to express nature every year the best way possible. So if you do a tasting, different vintages, every vintage is really different, every predicate is different, every vineyard is different. And that changes from year to year, and I think that's very fascinating. It makes it more complicated, more challenging. But I think it's the most fascinating both for us and also for the consumers, because every year they really have a different product. It's the same style, but it's a different expression of it.
And what was that 2003 first vintage out for yourself? What was that like? Did that present challenges in terms of the heat that year?
Yeah, it was. Now seeing back, it's probably different. In that time, it was just the first vintage I was really involved in. So, okay, that was the start. It was, of course, looking back, a very unique experience, and I'm glad I could make it together with my father, because he had that very long-term experience, and it was good to listen a lot to him and to discussed this vintage. We discussed it a lot, probably the most of all vintages we did. He often referred to 59 as a vintage because there were many parallels to these years. And I remember very well during harvest, we went to the vineyards quite a lot, or before harvest even more, to really check the condition of the grapes. And I remember quite well, and that was the only year when I really observed it in this way, that many younger vintners stopped us and said, oh, we are worried because the sugar levels are so high and the ripeness is so high. And it was sometime in September, and they were kind of panicking because the acidity levels were going down and down, and didn't really know what to do. Should we start harvest earlier than average, or should we wait? My father was very calm, and he said, well, don't worry, just wait. It's still too early. The sugar levels are there, but it's not really the ripeness that is there. So just be calm and wait. And he referred to 59, and that helped, I think, probably a few other vintners too, but especially me, to really learn how to deal with such an, maybe not perfectly usual year.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you do have such a track record of really high quality for so long. JJ Prum, having gotten started under its own label in the 20s, your dad's been there since 1969. So what has that history been like? Because I know there's S.A. Prum and you used to be together. And can you kind of chart for me the history of what you have now?
So that is really going back quite a long way. The name as such, J.J. Prum, exists since 1911, but there's winemaking in the family since a couple of hundred years. It was different steps. The most far going back is probably something that happened similar in many cases in Germany and also in France, for example, was that most of the land was owned by the church. So in this period until probably the early 19th century, some family owners were involved through the church in viticultural processes, in vinification probably as well, but it was still mainly church owned. And then in the early 19th century, vineyards were auctioned off, and it was my family or my ancestors who bought a good portion of it. And for several generations in the 19th century, it was one estate called Prum that was quite successful and could really build up quite a good reputation already. The good thing in these days was that although there were usually several people in the or several kids in the generation, for like two or three generations, only one married or only one took over and siblings helped, but it was possible to keep it in one hand. And then, of course, this cannot happen forever. So the last head was Matthias Prum. He died around the turn from the 19th to the 20th century. He had seven kids, and in that generation it happened that the original estate finished and seven kids got a share each. So then one J.J. Prum was the oldest son. He inherited the part that he then called created as J.J. Prum Estate. S.A. Prum was another son. He created S.A. Prum Estate. There are several other ones. Dr. F. Weins Prum, different name now. Family owns different names, but still there are Losen, for example. Annie Losen's great-grandmother was a sister of J.J. Prum. So several estates finished or started from this origin, and they developed differently. J.J. Prum could hand over to his son in the 20s. With S.A. Prum, the estate was sold about, I think, 10, 15 years ago to a different family. But the original owner still represents the wines, but it's not family-owned any longer, for example. Different wine styles, so today we don't have a real connection. Of course, most of us are in the same village, but doing very different interpretations of the vineyard, some neighboring parcels, but different ideas, different philosophies today.
And one of your most famous vineyards is the Velliner Sonner, or the Sundial Vineyard in Vellin, which is also the town you live in. And there's a sundial in that vineyard. And is it true that one of your family members built that?
Yeah, that's correct. That was built by Jodokus Prum in 1842. That was one of the siblings in the original estate that didn't take over the estate, but he was very social, or very interested in supporting people, and so he was I think his aim for life was a little bit helping people and supporting people, and he had inherited probably some money, so he wanted to really give it back to people, and he built the Sonnenuhr both in Wehlen and also in Seltingen, which is also a vineyard where we own a little bit smaller portion, immediate neighbors, to give people a time orientation. In those days, it was very different to today. People didn't have watches. It was a very Catholic region. He, Jodor Kospoim, was very Christian, very Catholic. So he thought, well, to go to church, for example, is helpful to have a clock, but also for different reasons, when to go back at home. So it was a time orientation, and it had that more social idea, but it was then later on name giving for the vineyards.
And let's talk about some of the vineyards that you control today. What are the differences between Zeltinger Sonnenuhr and Wellner Sonnenuhr and, say, Gracher Himmelreich? What are the broad differences between those sites?
So these three sizes, as well as the Bernkastel Abatschube, which is the fourth vineyard that we own, are all in the same slope. You must imagine it's a very deep valley with very steep vineyards. In the Mosel, most of the vineyards are steep. All top vineyards are steep because it's a very cool climate. It's the coolest climate for wine growing in Europe. If you look back to 20, 30, 40 years ago, there were quite some off vintages per decade because we just didn't get enough ripeness. Now with global warming, situation is better for us. We get more ripeness. It's not a question of ripeness or a question whether vintage is good or bad. Since the last 20 years or so, we've only had good to excellent vintages. The difference was more the character of the vintage rather than the quality. That is the condition. So then this deep valley, vineyards more or less south facing. You need the sunshine to really get enough ripeness, and all neighbors. So this is probably the biggest stretch of Riesling steep slopes that exists, at least in Europe. And it's for vineyards next to each other, all basically southwest facing, but the sun exposition is changing a little bit. Most south in the Wehlener Sonnenuhr and Seltinger Sonnenuhr, then slightly more west facing for the Gracher Himmelreich, and again more west facing for the Bernkasteler Bartstube. Also a little bit flatter is the Bernkasteler Bartstube. So little differences in the sun exposition, that's one thing, in the steepness. And the third thing is composition of soil. It's all gray slate soil, all decomposed, so it's very soft. You can see the rocks, but if you often when you take them in your hands, you can break them by hand. So it's very soft, giving a lot of minerals to the vines. But the composition is a little bit different. For the Zeltinger Sonnenuhr, it's less deep, so the vines hit the slate rock, which is underneath, quite easily. And for the Gracher Himmelreich, it's probably the deepest soil on top of the slate rock. Also, probably most water in the Gracher Himmelreich, but enough water also in the Wehlener Sonnenuhr. So it's in a hot year, maybe the water supply is a little bit better in the Gracher Himmelreich, but we've never had any problem, even in 2003, which was that extreme year, also in the Wehlener Sonnenuhr, because of deep roots that always find enough water in the deeper areas of the soil.
And it is, in all those vineyards, it's all Riesling. You have a little Optima, but it's somewhere else.
No, we have 100% Riesling. My father experimented a little bit with a few other grape varietals in the, I think, late 70s, but that's long, long ago. So it's 100% Riesling in our case, because we think for this climate and these soils, Riesling is just the ideal grape varietal, and we didn't want to waste any land for another grape varietal, which might be interesting to experiment with, but not really producing the great wines we can do with Riesling.
And is it true that a number of those vines are ungrafted vines?
Yes, it's a quite good portion which is ungrafted. Phylloxera has never been a problem in our region, and we are very happy, of course, to have the chance to still work with these mostly ungrafted vines.
And what's the average age in a vineyard like the Wellner Sonnenuhr of the vines?
It's a little bit difficult to say. It varies a little bit, but I would say maybe 50 years. But you find many vines that are more than 100 years old, for sure. The way we cultivate our vineyards is so-called eternal viticulture, meaning we only replant single vines and do not replant the whole vineyard. So there's wine viticulture since 2,000 years. And the soil allows this monoculture without really stopping. I know in other wine regions, after 20 or 30 years, you need to remove the vines and let the soil
regenerate.
That's something we do not need to do, so we can continue the viticulture continuously, and we will plant single vines once they are too old. Usually there are some exceptions with reallocation at the moment, so there are a few vineyards that need to be newly planted, but the general thing is just replanting single vines. So maybe 40-50 years, it might be 60 years average. We don't count concretely, but it's quite a lot of decades for sure.
And what are the different styles of wines that you make from those vineyards? I know you have different Prädikat releases, you know, Cabernet, Spätlese, Alsace, etc. And then you also make Trocken wine?
Hardly any Trocken wine. We concentrate on the fruity style, as it is often called, or off-dry style of wines. It's not, we don't like the word sweet wines, because sweet wine is a Sauternes or a dessert wine that is really, really sweet. And if you try a Cabernet, it has nothing to do with a sweet wine. If you show it to somebody blindly, usually people say, oh, what a great dry wine. So it's not bone dry. They are not fermented absolutely through. They have left a little bit of residual sugar, but this is not to make the wine sweet. It's only to balance the quite high acidity, usually to transport the fruit aromas, the long hang time, and the special aromas can be very nicely expressed by a little bit of residual sugar, just by not really letting the wines ferment completely through. And we do wild yeast fermentation only, so we don't add any yeast. We just let the yeast, which are on the grape skins and the cellar, let them ferment the wines into alcohol, or the sugar into alcohol, and we just don't aim to have a full fermentation, but are happy if the wine stop, or the yeast stop the fermentation eventually.
So you don't use cultivated yeast, and I wonder if that leads to the sensation of what they call sponti in some of the wines.
Yeah, definitely. Sponti is spontaneous fermentation, and the young wines often have this special smell and taste. Which for us is very usual. I, as a kid, could never understand people really talking about it, because it was very normal to me. But because many wines are produced with cultivated yeast, which are usually a little bit rounder, and maybe not as, they don't have as many edges and corners as spontaneous fermentation has. Usually when it's young, it's more wild, less harmonious. Needs a little bit longer, but it's something we think gives a lot of character to the wines, and what we like. And we think a wine shouldn't be, or doesn't have to be, perfect the time when it's released, but it should really have a long age. It should really enhance and get better with time. And if the wine isn't ready right from the beginning on, it's fine with us. But of course, you need to know. And this special smell and taste is something you need to explain to somebody who has never experienced it and only knows a different style of wine. That's for why we, for example, recommend decanting the wine, because that really helps to blow it off.
And there's sometimes people smell or taste sponti flavors and confuse them with high addition of sulfur.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I'm very happy that you mentioned that, because that is an impression I get quite often. And I discussed this also with both with colleagues and with a professor at Geisenheim University, because people often confronted me with the question, oh, are you using more sulfur? And I checked with colleagues and asked them, how much sulfur do you use? What are your references? And I was astonished that often they gave me higher numbers than we use. So I thought that cannot be the explanation, but I didn't have a real explanation. So I went to this professor and asked him, and he said, it's very complicated. They are doing some research on it, but it's very complicated to explain. But what they can say for sure is, during wild yeast fermentation process, there are different aromas built. Of course, that's what you smell. And one of the aromas that is built is also something chemically similar to sulfur. It's not the same sulfur that you add, but it's smelling similar. And that's what people really get confused about. And that's why there's sometimes this talking about, oh, Prüm uses so much sulfur, but in the truth is we use maybe as much as colleagues, maybe even less.
And what is that winemaking like? You use fooder when you age the wines?
Or stainless steel.
Stainless steel, yeah. The whole way through.
Yeah.
And because your winery is famously not visited by people in terms of no one's allowed to see it, or no one has seen it for a while. What's down there? What's in the secret room?
There is no secret room. We today make a joke a little bit out of it. The fact is that it's really a working area. So it's a cellar which has different corners. It's something that was built and then made bigger in generations, but it's not something, not it's not a showroom. It's anything but a showroom. So you have the steel stainless steel tanks, and you have the bottles in the vessels there, and it's all mixed because it's not something that was constructed on one day and planned perfectly. It's something that grew in generations. And my father took people down because some people request that and ask, can we see the cellar? They think it's interesting. So my father, I don't know, in the 80s or 70s, he took down people and said, okay, let's see. I'm not really recommending it, but if you want to see, okay. And he was showing it to people, and people were kind of disappointed because it wasn't really what they were expecting. You see the pictures of the beautiful cellars in Bordeaux or some new constructed cellars also in Germany. Sometimes I'm very impressed to see them, and I think they're lovely to see and even do tastings there. But for us, it's really an absolute working area, and it's not really, not in any way made to be nice or to be a showroom. It's just working area. And at a certain point, my father said, why should I lead down people, disappoint them? They have these beautiful, romantic pictures in their mind of a cellar, and then they are led down, and they are very disappointed. So why should I do it? And all the people said, okay, can we go up again? So at a certain point, he said, I'm just not doing it any longer. And he stopped it. And then he refused when some people came and say, we shouldn't do it. And then somebody made up this story. Well, maybe there's a secret. And today, of course, it's fun for us. And we sometimes make it up a little bit, but there's just no secret.
Well, we don't want to take you by the dragon. That's the reason we don't want
exactly.
You down there.
That's what
I
sometimes say.
You know?
I usually tend to people to say to people now, well, if you go in, you can, but you won't get out again because no living being probably has experienced that. So, yeah.
It's like the Egyptian tombs. You can go see it, but you may not survive long after.
It's exactly. So it's fun. We make fun out of it, but it's really not nice. And it's for us, the cellar is a working place. When you go to a restaurant, unless it's really designed as a showing kitchen, you don't request to go to the kitchen. And it's a place where people work, and that's what they should do. They should be concentrated on it. And we don't want to put any effort in making it nice because it's not the key thing for us. And we don't want to make or build a showroom. I've been to Napa and really led through show cellars where I was sure there has never been a wine produced. So why should we do it? Or why should we change the whole structure of the cellar just to lead people through? It's the example with a restaurant, with a great restaurant. I think it's not, the idea is to have, when you do a tasting, you should have a nice room and sit there and taste the wines and concentrate on it. And the cellar doesn't tell you anything, the wines and the vineyards do. And that is also the main thing. The vineyard produces the quality, and the cellar is just a room where the transformation from grape juice to wine happens.
And you've mentioned that your wines tend to be fairly long-lived. If I were at the consumer level, how might I approach a current release of your wine? How many years should I have that in my cellar on average for the different styles and different vineyards?
That's a question that cannot easily be answered. That needs a couple of sentences. Let's start this way. My father, when he was younger, recommended people, I think, not to open a cabinet before it's 5 years or so old. A Spätlese maybe 10, Auslese 15, something like that. He absolutely changed it because first thing is everybody experiences wines differently and has different expectations. Some people love the young, juvenile, somehow wild style. They like, for example, the Sponti aromas. They think that is just part of our wines and they love it. And if a vintage does show it less pronounced than others, they are already disappointed. Some others tell me, well, I don't open a Auslese before it's 20 years, Spätlese before maybe 10 on cabinet, I don't know how many years. We, for example, like older wines a lot, like from the 80s, for example.
Me too.
unfortunately, the quantities aren't really huge, but even in our cellar, but that is something very nice. The wines are, the fruit usually is much more in the back, and the minerality is very pronounced. You see all the layers and the finesses in the wines quite well. But I also would not say since I have sometimes the option, I always open an older bottle. It depends on my mood, on the situation. Is it summer or winter? am I drinking it inside, outside, with food, without food, what kind of food? And the beauty, and that is one of the things I'm really happy with, and I wouldn't wish to choose or to change with any other winemaker in another region, is that we do have so many options. We do have the different predicates, we do have the different vineyards, we do have the different vintages and vintage characters, and we do have the different ageness levels. And you have a huge bouquet of possibility of different wines. You can do a 10 or 20 course menu with different wines, different ages, different predicates. And I think that's the beauty. And I think it's impossible to really give a recommendation. You can say, for example, if I had a menu or a menu and I had to pair wines with it, I would maybe start with a very young or a very, very old cabinet. Both can work fine. For example, last night we had an 81 cabinet as aperitif, which was very, very beautiful. But also in 2011 would have worked. Very young, still a little bit yeasty. Champagne, for example, has the yeasty note too. So that's something that works. And then except maybe for a cabinet, for the food, I like a few years of age. So for Spätlese, for example, a couple of years helps because the wines get a little bit calmer. And usually it's a little bit easier to match them with food. But then again, it depends. Is it spicy food? That usually can handle younger wines because spices are quite strong. So a wine that is younger and is still more powerful in primary aromas can hold better. If it's a very fine, pure dish, a little bit more age helps. So you really have a lot of option, and maybe it's a little bit complicated because I cannot just say, okay, this is the rule. But that's, again, as I said earlier, there are no rules, and it's experience, and it's also fun, and it's also fun to have maybe younger and an older vintage next to each other or different vineyards and really discuss in a group of people. And it happens that some person says, well, I prefer this, and the other person prefers this. It's also very subjective.
And what foods are you typically drawn to eating with your own wines in the different categories?
Depends on many things. On the season, for example, what we get, we like game a lot with wines because we have a little hunting area and we grew up with game, venison or wild boar. So that's something just because it's regional and it's traditional that we do slow cook wild boar or venison in Riesling for couple of hours and then have an old Auslese with it, like 15, 20 years old. Beautiful match. But also, in summertime, we do have tomatoes in our garden. So tomato salad with just gentle balsamico vinegar and a little bit of olive oil can be beautiful. Some pasta can work well. I like to cook Asian food. So that works too. So I like to cook and I like to experiment a lot. And there are a lot of things, and I think these wines are some of the most versatile to match with food. They have this slight residual sugar, but it's not really, as I said, sweet wine. And the interesting thing is when you really pair these wines with food, I usually tell people, try the wine first and then try it with food again, and they taste much drier with food. They kind of adopt. That's also quite interesting phenomena because with food, you often don't think about the sweetness in food. Most dishes have some sweetness. If it's vegetables, you grill them, they develop some sweetness, or even piece of fish or meat. And so they're very versatile, and it's a lot of fun to experiment also. Or if you have a bottle and have different dishes and try the wine with different dishes, it's a lot of fun. Even oysters is something I experienced a couple of years ago, how well these go with Riesling. So you have a lot of options.
And I guess we should mention that your wines are fairly low in alcohol compared to wines across the world. What do they typically ring in at on the alcohol level?
It's usually between 7 and 9.5, maybe one, sometimes it goes up to 10, but that is already at the upper limit. So usually between 7 and 9.5, which is another beauty because you can drink several glasses and you're still happy and fit and don't get tired, but rather get more appetite to drink more and eat more. So that's a nice aspect to it as well.
And one of the things that's really pretty amazing and laudable about your winery is that it has pretty much an unbroken string of great releases from going back almost the beginning of the 20th century at always a very high quality level, which not a lot of wineries in the world can say for one reason or another. What are certain vintages that have really drawn your attention or you've learned from over the years? What are vintages that you have pulled out from the cellar and those drinking experiences have really caused you to see the wines or what you're doing in a different way?
I think the approach has always been more or less the same. Always trying to really produce the best quality possible. And if a wine wouldn't be really of the highest quality we would expect from a wine, we wouldn't sell it. So we would never sell a wine which we are not 100% behind. Also working with nature, not really saying we want this or we want this, whatever predicates or this style of wine. We really want to express nature every year, and that makes a different wine every year, because the weather, the climate conditions are different every year. And that has always been the approach. We see our role as human beings as a very minor or low part in the whole aspect. The nature is really what forms the wine, what produces the wine, and we just try not to do a mistake in bringing it from the vineyards to the bottle, so to say. And I think this has always been the case. Of course, you develop certain things. In the old times, there was nothing but wood available. But then, even in these days, for example, my grandfather, when he bought a new barrel, he was really treating it for a couple of years. First with hot and cold water many times, and then he put in a wine that he didn't sell in bottles for about 3 years to really make sure there was 100% no influence from the oak to the wine, taste-wise. And then later on, when stainless steel was available, everybody was happy to change to that, because it's maybe even more neutral, and we just don't want any impact from the vessel or from the barrel or from the tank the wine is stored in. So it should be 100% the quality and the taste from the vineyard into the bottle. And that has always been the same approach. I think this focus on quality, whatever happens, is something that has been very important. If you ask me about vintages, it's hard to say, because on the one hand, of course, you think of the great vintages, like maybe 21, 49, 59, 71, 76, and so on. On the other hand, for example, last night we had this 81 Cabernet, and everybody was so happy, and it was not a great vintage. Spätlese was the best predicate we could produce in a very small quantity, so they had a slight greenish taste, not unripe, but also not super ripe. And I wouldn't say these vintages impressed me less, maybe at least as much, because it shows that even in such vintages, those vineyards can produce high qualities. And also the question, if somebody asks me which vintage is your favorite one or which do you prefer, I cannot really tell, because I love the versatility. And I think the different characters are great. Some people say, well, 2003 is not my thing. Others say, oh, it's the greatest thing. We have a very high opinion about the vintage, for example, 2003, which was very, very controversial. But I would never think of it as inferior or better. It's just different characters, like human beings. You have friends that are different characters, but you like them all. And it's the same with wine. The quality is good of all wines we really release. And it's just different characters, and both impress me equally, both the great vintages, but also those who are not as great considered, but still produce good quality and have a lightness or a certain character that is as tempting.
And perhaps because you've had a long history at the estate of making good wine, there have been a few different importer relationships over the years. And when I go to buy the wines now, I notice that sometimes they're imported by someone and other times they're imported by someone else. What is the current situation? How has that developed with the import of your wines?
Yeah, this is talking about the U.S. In most countries, we do have just one importer, which usually is the best solution, because it makes things easier, and it's one person who's responsible for the wines and it's representing the wines in a country. But in England and in the United States, we do have several wines, and that has historical reasons. In England, even much further back, that was our first export market. We started, I think, before Second World War already, but that grew, and there was just one doing a certain portion and then another being in another region, so that grew. In the United States, we had more or less one big one in, I think that he started in the late 50s, and he worked very successfully both with my grandfather and with my father for a couple of decades.
This is Schumacher?
Kendermann.
Oh, okay, sorry.
So he was probably working with him, but that was the German, or at least the German shipper. And I don't know if he also had an import company, but he was at least shipping. And sometimes if you see old label or old bottles, it has this strip label still saying Kennemann. But he, I think, Schoonmaker, probably Chateau and Estates, he provided the wines to all these companies. And then he quite suddenly sold his company, and which was quite a difficult situation for my father, because it was United States tradition is a very good and very big market for us. And if you have just one importer and you lose him more or less from one day to the other, it's not an easy situation. And then Rudy Wiest came up, who just had started to found his own business. And he started, and he did a very good job. But then also Falkenberg, which is the second importer which we work with at the moment, he also started, and he didn't start because it's a very old German wine import and export company. But they started to grow in the United States, and they approached my father and also started to work with our wines. And both of them couldn't really do the same thing that had been previously done by Kennemann, because they were coming from different directions, but both only kind of taken over part of it. And then they developed very successfully. There were also some others we worked with, all some maybe through original connections, but now through different shipping agents. And we had, by I think like 10, 15 years ago, we had 5 importers or so, which all had traditional reasons or historical reasons, because it was old connections. And some old connections just revitalized or brought back to life. But we finished most of these because it was just too much. They all were growing, and there is maybe space for 2, but not for too many, because then the one grows to another state, and then there's the other one, and then they fight. It doesn't make sense. But for these 2. Since they traditionally did a lot of us, they still are working both with us, which sometimes can be a little bit confusing, but they both did a good job for us, and that's why we continue with both.
So what is the, because here in America, my own, just talking to people, a lot of people put J.J. Prum at the very height of German wine producers, or in the top couple year after year. What is the perception of the wines that you make in Germany? In terms of stylistically, are people moving more towards a drier style in terms of German consumption?
No, it's in Germany, it's a very different picture to probably what you experience here. I mean, you know, get the picture better here than I do. But my impression is that people think, because I think there are more and more dry German wines being imported to the United States. That's why the perception here is, well, there's more and more dry wine produced, and the whole production goes into the dry wine direction. In Germany, it's from our perspective very different, because we have always concentrated focused on the fruity style. However, my father, for example, in the 80s, he produced some dry wines in Germany. I think in America, hardly anybody knows them, and they were really designed only for the German market. I think in those days, he said it was nearly impossible to sell fruity style wines. But we went lower and lower in this production. The wines were nice, but it's not really our passion, and we think the style we do is the most fascinating, the most unique in the world, so why should you really start to compete with many other great dry wine producing regions and estates? So our focus was really very much on the fruity style, and still is. And in Germany, it's an interesting picture, because we were much less represented in Germany in the past. We were very, very export-driven and really exported the big, big majority of wines. Now we get more and more requests in Germany for the fruity-style wine. So a different picture to hear for us. German market is growing for the fruity-style wines, and the perception you get here is probably partly caused by, I don't know the statistics, but in the past, I think the big, big majority of wines imported to the U.S. were from the Mosel. And the Mosel traditionally has this fruity style wines. Wines from Rheinhessen, for example. Rheingau, a little bit different maybe, but Rheinhessen or Pfalz also, they weren't as strong, especially like more the new regions like Rheinhessen, for example, which are much stronger in dry wines. They weren't really exporting. And also Pfalz, very strong in the domestic market, and just not probably caring too much about. And these two are now put more efforts in getting into the US. And for these regions, the dry wine fits much better. I, for example, when I taste the wine from the Pfalz, in most cases, I prefer the dry wines. It's a very different climate. It's not far from us, but it's an absolutely different climate to the Mosel. Usually the wines there are, yeah, the climate just fits dry wines very well. And they are getting stronger. And that is, I think, the picture you get here now, because they are getting stronger. Some Mosel producers also do now produce more dry wines, but it's the main reason why you see more dry wines, I think, is because these regions are really trying to get stronger into this market.
And you've mentioned a bit about experiments that your father made somewhat earlier in his career with different grape varieties or with different styles of dryness. Are there experiments that you would be curious to carry out in your own future career at Prüm?
From perspective of today, no, not really, because I think the style we do is something which is very well developed and it's very fascinating. I personally like it a lot. I love this fruity style wines. As I said, for different other regions, I usually prefer dry wines, but for the Mosel, I absolutely love this style of wines. I think it's so unique, this interplay between the fruitiness, the acidity, and the minerality, slight minerality, and also the low alcohols are just absolutely great. And I wouldn't really like to waste my grapes for other experiments, both with other grape varietals, which can be great in other regions, but I'm very convinced that for the Mosel, Riesling is just the ideal grape varietal, and also style-wise. So I think, never say never, but from this perspective now, I think there are so many great dry wines, even dry Rieslings in the world, but there are so little wines of this style. And I think it's much more fascinating to introduce this style to new people. There's much more space for these wines than we can produce. And I think it's just more fun to concentrate on this style and really make people happy with this.
One of the things that's sometimes been confusing to me in my own career is understanding exactly how the gold capsule and long gold capsule fit into your production and what those are and how they're represented. Can you tell us a little bit about those bottlings?
Yeah, so gold capsule, long gold capsule is an invention by Vintners. It's something that is not defined by German law. German like to give a lot of regulations, but this is something which is actually a consequence of a prohibition of the terms feine Auslese, feinste Auslese, hochfeine Auslese that was allowed until the late, early 70s. So 71 had a huge change in German wine law, and since then it was not allowed to use these terms any longer to differentiate in the Auslese category. However, the Auslese category can have very different phases. Auslese can be made of grapes that is just very, very ripe, golden colored, very ripe grapes, but you can also have some botrytis in it. So you have the next higher predicate is Bärenauslese, but Bärenauslese means 100% botrytis. Auslese can be zero botrytis, can be 50% botrytis, for example. And we think it's an Auslese made just of very high golden colored, very ripe grapes is a different thing to a product that has maybe 30 or 50% of botrytis. That these are different styles. The taste is different. The concentration is different. And we wouldn't like to put this all into the same barrel. So we like to differentiate because these are really different styles, also have different functions for us. A regular Auslese is still a food wine, maybe something to have with cheese. But other than that, usually with some age, more for food wines. While a gold capsule with some botrytis is something maybe you have with foie gras, but you can also have with a not too sweet dessert, for example. So different pictures, different characters. And this was all already expressed in these terms, feine Auslese, feinste Auslese. And since it was prohibited and people, Vintners, my father and colleagues, still wanted to produce and to differentiate, they invented the golden capsule. It's something that's, as I said, not defined by German law. It's something also that not every producer do. There are even some that use a golden capsule for all wines, but more often it's that they use either gold capsule or they use star system. Like you also find producers that use 1, 2, 3 stars or Fuder numbers. It's all a consequence of this prohibition of law. I know it's getting sometimes a little bit complicated, but I think the gold capsule system is something many producers use, and it's something that is maybe, once you have gotten an explanation, most easy to understand because it has a certain logic behind it. And so for our wines, if they have a golden capsule, usually it means some botrytis in it. The long gold capsule is something which is very rare. It's often asked, but you hardly see the bottles. It's usually wine that we only auction at the VDP Trier, VDP Mosel auction in Trier, which is happening every year. That's an auction where most of the VDP members of the regional Mosel section auction their best barrels, usually quite small portions. It's Bärenauslesen, TBA, gold capsules, sometimes even a Spätli, a very brilliant one, very small quantities. And long gold capsules are usually auctioned there. You can see them once in a while in the market, but it's usually only auctioned in that specific event in late September. If you find a bottle and you're not sure, maybe you buy it or it's offered at an auction here in the US or so, and you're not sure if it's a gold capsule or long gold capsule. The long gold capsule has, since I think the early 90s, two white stripes on the bottom, while the regular gold capsule only has one. So that is something my father did on purpose, because if you don't have the two bottles next to each other, how do you know if it's a long or a short
one?
So
that's long to me.
Exactly. Yeah. So we often also get emails asking us that. And if it's a wine which is 90 or younger, it's usually indicated by the two white stripes at the bottom line. So golden capsule, but two white stripes indicating it's a long gold capsule.
And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your father. He took over the estate in 69. It seems to me that the focus of the winery really is on the vineyards, but I wonder how he's most impressed you, or what you feel that he might be most proud of in his career.
So proud is, I think, a word we do not really like. We are not proud of something. We try to do a good job, but we are not really proud. That's not, we don't sit down and say, oh, we are proud of this and this. My father, I think he would hate the question if you asked him that. He would, I think the thing that is one of his big, what I think was his one of the best aspects he did was really focusing on a certain style and being convinced or really continuing this style, even if there were critics. Like, for example, this spontaneous fermentation. In the 80s, he had huge problems. Maybe it's not really known here, but in Germany, many journalists attacked him because of this style, because they said, oh, the wines are faulty and blah, 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 very bad. It was really a fight with journalists. And I think it was a quite hard time for him. Today, I cannot remember this, and we cannot imagine how bad that was in these days. But he just continued because he was convinced that it was the right thing. And I think that was good. Today, you hear many young vintners saying, oh, I think it's so great what he did, and I want to do the same, and spontaneous fermentation is it. Sometimes I think it's even a little bit too much made up. It's the absolute contrast of what happened in the 80s. Sometimes today, even journalists write, my father was the pioneer of spontaneous fermentation, which is absolutely nonsense, because the Romans already, I mean, in old times, there was no alternative to white yeast fermentation. So it's really silly to say he was the pioneer, but at least it's recognized today that it's a good thing to do it this way, or it can produce very high quality and very characteristic wines. And I think that is something to really continue that and not be intimidated by some attacks. That was one of the key things. And then, of course, just the approach to say every year we try out to get the best possible. And if we're not 100% sure of a quality of a barrel, for example, we would not release it. So this really following, always trying to do the best and observing very closely and doing all the little steps, not forcing the wine, not saying we need to bottle in whatever March or April, just really observing the development of the grapes and the wines, harvesting late, all these little details which result in a great wine or in a not so great wine, to really focus and never really give up the energy to continue that. I think that's some of his merits.
And what about your younger sisters? Do you think in the future that one or both of them might join you at the winery in some capacity?
My youngest sister, no, for sure. My other sister, let's see. We don't know yet.
And I wonder, you mentioned a long harvest season, and it seems like it can be quite long. I've heard about harvesting in November. I'm sure there's times that are later.
Yeah.
What is the reality of that?
So if we look back to last year, vintage 2012, we started October 22nd and finished November 17, and that's not unusual. So it can be a little bit earlier. Usually it's between early October and late November, but it can be, yeah, like last year 22nd, vintage 2008 just started October 25th. So that is quite normal and can last until November, can even last until December. That is so let's say second half of October and November is usually the core harvest time.
So it's probably pretty cold in those vineyards.
Yes, it's pretty cold. Also, it's certain risk because the later it gets in the year, the more unstable the weather can get. But we love the long hang time, and it's something that is possible in the Mosel, and it lets the wines develop a much better structure and much better and deeper aromas, and also transport the minerals for a very long time into the grapes. And we are happy about that possibility.
Well, I enjoy the wines quite a bit as well. Thank you, Katerina Prum of the JJ Prum Winery, for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
It was wonderful to speak with you. The exclusive sponsor of I'll Drink to That is 750, a powerful and easy-to-use online search tool for wholesale buyers of wine and spirits in New York and New Jersey. 750 incorporates over 100 distributor portfolios and a number of unique features that make the lives of buyers simpler and more productive. I'll Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker, and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe, alldrinktothatpod.com, or on Twitter at drinktothatpod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.